Okay, so let's dive into a case that'll really get you thinking about power dynamics in the workplace. Imagine it's late, you're asked to stay at work with your boss,
Oh yeah.
alcohol's involved, things get a little out of hand.
Sure.
How does the law determine if this is just a bad situation or if it crosses the line into sexual assault?
Right. Well, that is the question at the heart of State v. DiPietrillo, and it's a 2007 Rhode Island Supreme Court case that grapples with the concept of force or coercion in sexual assault. What's fascinating about this case is how it tries to define when psychological pressure, especially in a workplace setting, becomes criminal.
And we've got all the materials to break this down: legal briefs, court opinion,
Oh, wow.
the whole shebang.
Oh, great.
So to set the scene, we're dealing with Craig DiPietrillo.
Okay.
He's a 30-year-old business owner, and Jane, his 19-year-old employee.
Okay, so right away, you've got that inherent power imbalance there. It's March 20, 2002. And Jane is asked to stay late at work. She has to miss her evening class. They run errands, pick up takeout, and even grab some beer.
You're in the office with your boss
Yeah.
after missing class.
It happens.
Doesn't sound like a typical work night, does it?
No, it's this context that becomes really important later on because back at the office, things escalate. DiPietrillo makes advances towards Jane despite her protests. We're talking about him pulling her onto his lap, touching her breast, and even digital penetration.
So this is definitely crossing a line. And it sounds like Jane is actively trying to resist, telling him to stop, pushing him away. So how does this turn into a legal battle?
Well, DiPietrillo is charged with both first A and D, second degree sexual assault. First degree in Rhode Island involves penetration, while second degree focuses on sexual contact.
So they're saying he's guilty of both because of the different types of assault that occurred.
The case goes to trial, a bench trial, meaning there's no jury, just a judge deciding the verdict. And he's found guilty on both counts. You might think case closed, right?
Seems pretty straightforward at that point.
But it's not over yet. DiPietrillo appeals, claiming the encounter was consensual. He also argues for a new trial based on newly discovered evidence about Jane's behavior after the assault.
Hold on. So now he's saying she acted in a way that suggests it was consensual.
Right.
This is where it gets really complicated, isn't it?
It does. And this is where the Rhode Island Supreme Court steps in. But here's the twist. They don't just uphold or overturn the lower court's decision. They affirm the denial of a new trial based on the new evidence. But they also vacate the initial conviction and send the case back to the lower court.
Wait, they vacated the conviction. It sounds like they're saying he's not completely innocent, but not necessarily guilty either. What's going on here?
They vacate the conviction because they think the judge may have misapplied the whole concept of psychological coercion when making his decision.
Ah, so this idea of psychological coercion is at the heart of the case. Could you break that down for us a bit?
Absolutely. Rhode Island law uses a three-part test to figure out if there was force or coercion in a sexual assault case. First, you have physical force or violence.
Yeah, that's pretty clear cut. What are the other two parts?
The second part is threats of force or violence. But the victim has to reasonably believe the threat is real, that the person can actually carry it out.
So an empty threat wouldn't count. It has to be a believable threat for it to qualify as coercion.
And then we get to the third part, the one that's really key in this case, psychological pressure on a vulnerable victim. This is where things get more nuanced.
That makes sense. You can't always see psychological pressure. Like you can see a physical act.
Right.
So how do they determine if that pressure was actually coercive?
Well, the Supreme Court brings up a previous case, State v. Burke, to try to illustrate this concept. In Burke, a police officer used his inherent authority to coerce someone into sexual acts. Because he was a cop, his words and actions held a lot of weight, creating a coercive environment.
So they're trying to figure out if a boss holds the same kind of authority as a police officer in this situation.
Does that workplace power dynamic automatically make everything coercive? That's the question the court is grappling with in DiPietrillo.
Yeah.
And as you might imagine, there are some differing opinions on this.
Okay, so there's a split decision within the Supreme Court.
Yes.
I'm guessing this is where the different opinions come into play.
Exactly. We have a majority opinion, a dissent,
right,
and even a concurring opinion, each adding a different layer to this puzzle.
All right, things are definitely getting interesting now. Let's take a closer look at what each of these opinions says.
Okay.
The majority focuses on the fact that DiPietrillo wasn't a figure of authority in the same way a police officer is.
Mm-hmm.
They felt the judge might have wrongly applied the standard from the Burke case, where that power dynamic was much clearer.
Yeah.
So they're saying a boss's power isn't automatically the same as a cop's power when it comes to the law.
Right.
I can see how that could be a point of contention.
Exactly. They argue that just because there's a hierarchy in the workplace doesn't mean every interaction is automatically coercive. They think the focus should be on whether there was enough evidence of physical force alone to justify the conviction.
Interesting. So they're sending it back to be reexamined.
Right.
But with a much narrower focus on physical force.
Right.
What about the dissenting opinion? How did they view this whole coercion issue?
Well, Justice Flaherty, who wrote the dissent, takes an even stronger stance.
Okay.
He argues that there shouldn't even be a retrial. He believes that regardless of whether it was physical or psychological, the state didn't prove force or coercion beyond a reasonable doubt.
Wow. So the dissent is saying the whole case should be thrown out.
Yes.
That's a pretty big difference in interpretation.
It is.
What about the concurring opinion? Where do they stand on this?
Justice Robinson, who wrote the concurrence, focuses solely on the issue of coercion.
Okay.
He agrees that psychological coercion needs more context than just a power imbalance, but doesn't say whether or not he thinks it applies to DiPietrillo's case.
So he's adding another layer of complexity to this already complicated issue.
Exactly. And that's what makes this case so fascinating.
Right.
We have these three different perspectives.
Yeah.
All grappling with this really nuanced concept of coercion, especially within a workplace setting.
It sounds like this case has some serious implications for how we understand consent, not just in the courtroom, but in our everyday lives.
You're absolutely right.
Wow.
State v. DiPietrillo sets a precedent in Rhode Island, making it clear that psychological coercion requires more than just a power imbalance.
Right.
But it definitely raises more questions than it answers.
Yeah.
Leaving us with a lot to think about.
So we've got this split decision, you know, this cloud of uncertainty kind of hanging over the case.
Right.
It makes you wonder, like, what are the practical implications of this for lawyers, especially those dealing with sexual assault cases?
Yeah, it really underscores how much one case can have a ripple effect. You know, for prosecutors, DiPietrillo emphasizes the need to be incredibly precise when making charging decisions.
Okay.
They have to carefully consider whether they're alleging physical force, psychological coercion, or both.
So they can't just throw everything under the umbrella of force or coercion.
Right.
They really need to think strategically about which path they're going to take.
Exactly. Because as DiPietrillo shows, proving psychological coercion is a lot harder.
Okay.
Particularly when the defendant isn't a traditional authority figure like a police officer.
So if a prosecutor is going with psychological coercion, they need to be ready to demonstrate a level of authority comparable to law enforcement. That seems like a pretty high bar to clear.
It is. They have to convince the court that the defendant's position created an environment where the victim felt genuinely unable to consent, not just uncomfortable or pressured.
Right.
That's a subtle but crucial distinction.
This is fascinating stuff. We're seeing how one case can really change the game.
Yeah.
But what about the defense?
Uh-huh.
Could DiPietrillo actually work in their favor?
Absolutely. DiPietrillo provides a powerful tool for defense attorneys to push back against an over-reliance on that Burke standard, where a police officer's authority was considered inherently coercive.
Right. It almost sets a precedent for what doesn't automatically qualify as psychological coercion.
Exactly. So if a defense attorney is dealing with a case where psychological coercion is being alleged,
right,
and the defendant isn't a traditional authority figure, like in the Burke case, they can point to DiPietrillo and say, hold on, the prosecution needs to prove more than just a power imbalance here.
So it's not enough to say he was the boss, therefore she felt pressured.
Right.
They need to demonstrate a level of coercion that goes beyond the typical dynamics of a boss-employee relationship.
Precisely. DiPietrillo forces us to think critically about the nuances of these situations.
Yeah.
It's not always black and white.
That's a good point. It seems like this case has implications beyond just the legal system. You know, it makes you think about consent, power, and vulnerability in all sorts of contexts.
You hit the nail on the head.
Oh.
One of the big takeaways from DiPietrillo is that the courts are hesitant to expand that concept of coercive authority beyond those really clear-cut power structures.
So just because someone's in a position of authority, like a boss or a teacher, doesn't mean their actions are automatically coercive.
Right.
It's not that simple.
Right. DiPietrillo draws a line,
okay,
making it clear that psychological coercion, in a legal sense, requires more than just a hierarchical relationship.
Right.
There needs to be that element of authority similar to a police officer or prison guard.
But isn't that a little unrealistic? I mean, we all know that power dynamics can absolutely influence consent, even if it's not as extreme as a police officer situation.
You're absolutely right. And that's why DiPietrillo sparks so much debate.
Yeah.
It shines a light on just how complex consent is, especially when you factor in power imbalances.
It almost feels like the law is playing catch-up, trying to figure out how power dynamics actually operate in the real world.
Exactly. And DiPietrillo doesn't give us all the answers.
Right.
It leaves us with some really big questions.
What kind of questions? On all ears.
Well, one of the big ones is, should workplace power imbalances ever be considered inherently coercive?
Yeah.
Even if it's not to the same degree as, say, a police officer's authority?
Yeah.
It really makes you rethink how we approach these situations.
That's a tough one. It's like, we're being asked to redefine our understanding of power dynamics in the workplace. It's not as simple as saying, he's the boss, therefore it's coercive.
Right.
There's a lot more to it.
Exactly. DiPietrillo forces us to look at the gray areas of consent.
Mm-hmm.
It recognizes that psychological coercion exists, but sets a high bar for proving it, leaving us to grapple with the nuances of these situations.
So thinking practically, what does this mean for someone who finds themselves in a situation similar to Jane's?
Mm.
What advice would you give them?
That's a critical question, and unfortunately there isn't a simple answer.
Yeah.
What DiPietrillo does highlight is the importance of knowing your rights and recognizing when a situation crosses the line from uncomfortable to potentially criminal.
Okay.
It's about trusting your gut and understanding your boundaries.
It seems like communication and setting boundaries are crucial, especially when you're dealing with someone who has a position of power over you, making it clear what you're comfortable with and what you're not.
Absolutely. And if you ever find yourself in a situation where you feel pressured or coerced, it's essential to seek help and support.
No.
There are resources available like hotlines and advocacy groups that can offer guidance and assistance.
Yeah.
You don't have to go through this alone.
It's so important to remember that you're not alone, and there are people who can help you navigate these difficult situations.
Mm-hmm.
We often focus on the legal side of things, but the human element is just as important.
I couldn't agree more. And while DiPietrillo may not provide all the answers, it definitely shines a light on how complex consent is and highlights the need for an ongoing conversation about power dynamics in our society.
This deep dive has been incredibly insightful. We've explored the specific facts of the case, its impact on the legal system, and even its broader implications for how we understand consent and power.
Right.
But there's one piece of the puzzle we haven't touched on yet.
Uh-huh.
The dissent's argument about double jeopardy.
Yes. Justice Flaherty, in his dissent, brings up some really interesting points about the potential for double jeopardy if DiPietrillo were to be retried based solely on the evidence of physical force.
Okay, before we get into that, let's make sure everyone's on the same page.
Yeah.
Could you give us a quick refresher on what double jeopardy is?
Of course. Double jeopardy is a legal principle that prevents someone from being tried twice for the same crime.
Okay.
It's a fundamental right enshrined in the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution.
So in essence, you can't be punished twice for the same offense.
Right.
It's about protecting individuals from being unfairly targeted or harassed by the legal system.
Exactly. And that's where Justice Flaherty's argument comes in.
Okay.
He believes that sending the case back for a new trial focusing only on physical force could potentially violate DiPietrillo's protection against double jeopardy.
Because he's already been tried and convicted once, even though the conviction was vacated.
Yeah.
It's like they're trying to retry him on a narrower set of facts.
Right.
Which could be seen as a form of double jeopardy.
Precisely. His argument is that if the trial judge already considered the evidence of physical force and didn't find it sufficient for a conviction, then retrying the case based on that same evidence could be considered double jeopardy.
Okay.
It's a really compelling point.
It is. So how did the majority opinion address this concern? Did they offer any counterarguments to Justice Flaherty's claims?
Interestingly, they didn't directly engage with the double jeopardy argument at all. They simply state that they're remanding the case for further findings on the physical force aspect without addressing the potential double jeopardy implications.
So they kind of sidestepped that whole issue.
Yeah.
It seems like they left that question unanswered.
Right.
Which adds another layer of complexity to this already complicated case.
You're right. It's almost like a legal cliffhanger.
Yeah.
And that's what makes this case so fascinating to dissect.
Right.
It leaves us with more questions than answers, forcing us to think critically about the law power dynamics and how we define consent in all its messy complexity.
My brain is definitely full after this deep dive.
We've unpacked some really complex legal concepts. But for me, the biggest takeaway is how this case shows that our understanding of consent, coercion, and power is constantly evolving. Mm. It's not static.
I completely agree.
Yeah.
State v. DiPetrillo might be a case from 2007,
mm-hmm.
but the questions it raises are incredibly relevant today.
Right.
It challenges us to think critically about consent and advocate for a society where everyone feels safe and empowered to define their own boundaries.
Yeah, it's like this case is a snapshot in time capturing how we understood these issues back then, but also pointing towards all the work that still needs to be done.
Absolutely. And it really highlights why it's so important to stay informed, engaged, and willing to challenge the status quo when it comes to these issues of consent and power dynamics.
So as we wrap up our deep dive into State v. DiPetrillo, what are some key takeaways our listeners should keep in mind as they navigate their own lives and careers?
Well, I think the biggest takeaway is that the law is constantly changing.
Yeah.
You know?
What might have been considered acceptable behavior in the past might not be acceptable today.
Right, like how societal views on sexual harassment and assault have shifted dramatically in recent years.
Exactly.
What was once brushed aside is now being recognized as harmful behavior.
Exactly. So it's crucial to stay informed about the current laws and social norms surrounding consent, you know?
Right.
Things are constantly evolving.
And to remember that consent is an ongoing process, not just a one-time agreement.
You've got it.
Right.
Consent can be withdrawn at any time, and it's everyone's responsibility to respect those boundaries.
This case also highlights the need for clear communication, especially when there's a power imbalance.
Yeah, whether it's a workplace relationship, a teacher-student dynamic, or any other situation where one person has more authority, establishing clear expectations and boundaries around consent is so important.
And if you're ever in a situation where you feel uncomfortable or pressured, it's crucial to speak up and advocate for yourself.
Absolutely. And remember, you always have the right to say no at any time, regardless of the other person's position or authority.
Right.
Your feelings and your boundaries are valid.
We also can't forget the importance of supporting survivors of sexual assault.
Right.
Creating a culture where survivors feel safe coming forward is so important.
I couldn't agree more. We need to foster an environment where survivors can share their experiences without fear of judgment or retaliation, and where they have access to the resources and support they need.
It's about believing survivors, validating their experiences, and holding perpetrators accountable for their actions.
Exactly. State v. DiPetrillo might be just one case, but it opens up a much larger conversation about power, consent, and accountability in our society.
Right.
It's a conversation that requires nuance and understanding.
And it's a conversation we all need to be a part of, both in our personal lives and in our professional roles.
Mm. I think that's a great way to put it. So, if there's one thing we want our listeners to take away from this deep dive, it's this. Stay informed, be empowered, and advocate for a culture of consent.
And remember, if you or someone you know needs help, there are resources available.
Mm-hmm.
You are not alone.
Thank you for joining us on this journey through the complexities of State v. DiPetrillo.
Yes, thank you.
We hope it sparked some important conversations and encouraged you to think critically about these crucial issues.
Until next time, stay curious, stay informed, and stay engaged.